Well, it has been a very interesting year that we have cooked up for ourselves, don't you think? It's been so interesting, in fact, that we just have to pause to ask, is there a small farm in our future?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, folks, we have cooked up an interesting year for ourselves. We took a pandemic, and we mixed it up with a recession, and we threw in a lot of racial and religious animosities and some fires and some floods and baked it all up in an election. And so what a thing we have to eat for this year. And given all of the chaos and the confusion and the anxiety, you know, we just have to pause to ask, is there a way to get back to that small farm that Jefferson talked about? That place where we all would have an acre or two or three, and that by our own wits we could take care of ourselves and grow a community? Well, that's what we have on the table today. And we have it with Chris Smage, who is an author of A Small Farm Future. Chris, did I get your last name correct?
That was pretty good, Michael. Better than most.
Okay. And Chris is coming to us live today from his farm in Somerset, England, which is on the southwest part of England. And when you think small farm and small farm people, gosh, the British people just come up all the time because they're the ones who really perfected the art, I think. Or am I wrong, Chris?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's compared to the US, I guess we're pretty densely populated over here. So, there's a lot of people over the years who've been working small plots. Compared to our colleagues over in mainland Europe, farming in the UK has got a pretty large scale and pretty mechanized and industrialized. We're hanging on in there, some of us.
Well, and I also think of other small farm places, notably Japan that I've experienced, and also New Zealand. And it seems like when you don't have a lot of land, you have to use a little more ingenuity. We are with the notion of small farms. Now, you came to the whole notion of small farming from an academic world.
That's right. Originally, I was a university lecturer in social science and not particularly focusing on agricultural issues at all, actually. But when I sort of got into my 30s and, you start thinking about how the world works and, the sort of great cycle of life and so on, and started getting interested in it also because of all the environmental issues that we face nowadays, and it seemed to me that food was really at the heart of many of them, I stopped the academic gig and spent some years setting up a small farm and growing vegetables. But I kind of got drawn back into writing, and I guess this book emerged from the fact that we can talk all day about farming techniques and better and worse ways of doing farming, but I guess part of what I'm saying in the book is the problem isn't so much at the food production end, it's the bigger political and economic structures that farming fits into that make the food and farming system so problematic in many ways. So that's sort of where I go back to the social science in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the notion of a small farm in a big farm world is a interesting juxtaposition in itself. When I wrote my book called Metro Farm, about metropolitan agriculture, well, of course you're talking about small farms because there's no big farms in a metropolitan area. So you have to you have a small farm, but yet when I came out with the book Metro Farm, it was as if I had written a heresy, because agriculture did not want to have small farms because they simply didn't want the competition, I believe. It didn't want people growing their own food and selling it back and forth throughout the neighborhood. They want everybody to be buying from them. And so this the notion of a small farm in a big farm world is always going to be problematic, I think. But that's the interesting thing about it. And so you picked up this. Do you remember the moment, the epiphany that led you to think, you know, this is worthy of exploration, this is worthy of fighting for?
I mean, I don't know if there was any particular moment, but I think, you know, it's exactly as you were just saying. I think the sort of big narrative that we've all grown up with is, you know, let the big scale farmers with all the big kit take care of it. And, you know, we can all live in cities and do whatever it is we do there. And I think, you know, we can argue about to what extent that's worked in the past, but my argument in the book is it's probably not going to work in the future for all sorts of reasons. You know, we've become accustomed to a growing global economy, which, you know, we're not going to see the level of global economic growth in the coming years that we've seen over the last 50 years, over my lifetime. You know, climate change is huge issues. Where we get our energy from are huge issues. So, yeah, I mean, basically, that's where I'm coming from in the book, is that the best way of setting up renewable and human-centered societies is to relocalize. And certainly, as you say, you know, part of that has got to be people in towns and cities growing food for themselves, but also a different settlement in the countryside, you know, more people in the countryside doing more labor-intensive, low-carbon jobs. So, you know, I think, however, whatever happens in the future, you know, none of us can tell, of course, but I think it's going to look pretty different in 50 years' time to, you know, how it's been through most of our lifetimes.
Well, this will be an interesting exploration then. I'm looking forward to it. Let's start with where you started in your book, A Small Farm Future, and you put down 10 crises. Why did you start with trouble?
Well, I think, I mean, pretty much as your intro to the show suggested, you know, if you look at the things that have happened this year, even, you know, I think that there is a lot of trouble in the world. And, you know, as I was saying, things like climate change and the, you know, the way that we've used energy in the world over the last 50, 100 years, the way that we've grown economies and taken people out of farming and into cities, but not always given them the opportunities. You know, when you look at it in a global perspective, you know, not always given people good opportunities for economic betterment. And, you know, I think in one way or another, all of those things are coming back to haunt us now. So, you know, you know, part of the book is to say, you know, there are no kind of simple magic bullet solutions. You know, there's no magic wands to wave. But, you know, we need to sort of look at these problems that we're facing now with fresh eyes and perhaps be open to some, you know, we always tend to go for the sort of high tech solution that maintains the status quo. And I guess part of the book is to say, you know, hey, we need to kind of, look with a bit of a wider gaze than that now.
Well, you know, I'm looking at the list of the 10 crises: your population, climate, energy, soil, stuff, water, land, health and nutrition, political economy, and culture. And I'm getting it sounded like my open this morning. It's everything we've got in this year that we baked up for ourselves is big trouble. But one of the things that I'd like to pick up one of these crises and have you explain it to me, and that's the crisis of stuff.
Right.
What do you mean by stuff?
Well, really, the things, the stuff that that we use to you know, to live our lives and to thrive. I mean, I talked prior to immediately prior to that, I talk about soil, for example, and, you know, one of the problems with aspects of farming, certainly in some places, is that we're using it up in our farming practices faster than we can replenish it. And, you know, the chapter on stuff, it's just a very short chapter, really, that sort of puts that into a more human social context. You know, what do we need in order to live a modern life? You know, we need iron, we need concrete. Do we need those things? What are the consequences in terms of energy use? You know, can we provide enough of these things for everybody in the world to live a decent life, or do we need to rethink you know, the amount? Certainly in rich countries like here in the UK or in the US, you know, we use way more of these things than people in poorer countries. So you know, we need to sort of rethink the underlying stuff, the materials that we need to have a decent life. And of course, you can do that, you know, on a small scale farm. You know, there's a lot of things you can cycle. You know, you can live, you know, a pretty decent life with less material input than if you live in a big city, which is very energy intensive, and, you know, a lot of energy and resources go into getting everything to where people are and then taking all the wastes away, you know. So I think these are the sorts of things that we need to be debating, you know, more urgently than perhaps we generally are these days.
And you concluded your opening with a very interesting notion: return of the peasant.
Right.
Where does that take us?
Well, I think, you know, one thing I'm keen to try and address and move beyond in the book is, you know, we've got this very strong modern narrative about progress, you know, that in the past a lot of people worked the land, and, you know, we've moved on from that, and, you know, we can't go back, we can't turn the clock back. You know, turning the clock back is a phrase you hear a lot, and I'm just you know, I'm not suggesting that you know, what I'm trying to avoid in the book is a kind of any sort of nostalgic romantic vision about how everything used to be better in the past. You know, I think this whole debate about whether things are better or worse in the past is really beside the point. You know, the issue is, what problems do we face now, and what can we do about them? You know, where can we look for solutions? And basically, I think in the future, we're going to be looking at employment sectors where people are, you know, which are labor intensive, and which are low carbon, you know, where people are not drawing down on energy or producing carbon emissions, but the reverse. And, you know, small scale labor intensive farming is going to be key in that. So the return of the peasant section is really just, in a way, it's a little bit mischievous. It's, you know, when we talk about peasants, it's kind of a derogatory, you know, looking down on the past, you know. And I'm saying, you know, we need to look seriously at the way that people throughout history have figured out these low impact local farming systems that enable them to thrive locally, and you know, not to sort of just mindlessly try and replicate what was done in the past.
Yeah, let's pick that up when we come back from this break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Chris Smage, who is the author of A Small Farm Future, coming to us today all the way from Somerset, England, where they do have small farms. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
This is the Food Chain Radio program, and I am Michael Olson. Today we're talking about small farms. You know, to heck with this world. Let's move back to the small farm, where things are a little bit less complicated. We don't need as much stuff to get by. Chris, when you were talking about the stuff, I was just thinking of my house, which is a city house, and how the delivery man keeps bringing me these cardboard boxes filled with stuff. And pretty soon, nice. I have so much stuff. I institute a rule: for each new stuff that comes to my house, I have to get rid of three. But it never seems to work out that way. It just keeps building up and building up, and we get stuffed under. And
That's right. It
doesn't quite work like that on a small farm, because on a small farm, things have to have a reason and a place. And having been raised as a very young boy on a working farm, everything did have a place and a reason for being there. Everything from the tractor to the cat, everything had a reason and a place and a function in the world of the farm. And so what about the city? You know, you talk about how this isn't going to work, or at least that's the notion I hear from you, this business of big cities. You're not too hopeful on the future of big cities, are you?
Not really. I mean, I think, you know, we need to sort of rethink the whole hierarchy of geography, really. And, you know, one thing that's happened is that, you know, if you think of lower energy societies, you know, it takes a lot of energy to move, you know, heavy foods, fruit and vegetables, heavy kit of whatever kind. You know, it takes a lot of energy to move it around, and big cities are you know, at one level it can be quite efficient. You know, people talk about the efficiency of the city because you can just, you know, walk to your work or live in an efficient apartment block or whatever, and that is true to some extent. But the other side of that coin is that the whole city itself is a huge drain on energies that are not really local anymore, because fossil fuels in particular have enabled us to break the link between local production. You know, like a small city or a town in the past would be quite intimately connected with its surrounding hinterlands. You know, you think of, you know, the town Frome here in Somerset where I live, you know, used to be a little market town with a cattle market, and the farmers would, you know, bring their produce in and so on. And, you know, you get that kind of hierarchy from farmland to village to market town to provincial town and so on. And that's kind of all gone now because of the cheapness of energy. You know, that you can go into a supermarket here in Frome probably looks quite a lot like the supermarket and the sort of produce that you have available where you are, you know, which is from all over the world. And I guess what I'm arguing is that, I can't really see a way in which we're going to be able to continue living these high energy lifestyles that we have become accustomed to living whilst taking care of the climate and not emitting too much carbon. So, right, we need to rethink the way that we organize ourselves in space. I mean, I'm certainly not saying that that everybody has to be out in the countryside working on a farm. But I think more people than at present. And of course, in countries like Britain and the States, we tend to export, you know, the things that are costly in terms of labor, you know, the high cost stuff like fruit and vegetables. You know, we tend to export the responsibility for producing that to places where labor is cheaper. And again, there's a whole kind of energy cascade involved in that. So, really, I think if you think in terms of the sort of energy and climate futures we're facing, there is going to have to be some relocalization and some deurbanization.
Well, and it's not just energy that is problematic for the city. In looking at our cities these days, I see all kinds of other problems as well. I see cultural problems, religious problems, economic problems, political problems. It all seems to be, you know, really coming to a boil these days. Perhaps a big reason is we're having an election here in the States, but it's happening everywhere. The cities just seem to be becoming more contentious, more fraught with anxiety and fear. So I don't know. Maybe somebody does good future for the cities, but I'm not seeing it right now.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, one of the issues globally, when you look at so-called developing countries, the model has very much been getting people out of farming and getting them to the cities. And that's fine, you know, if there are better paid employment opportunities for people to go to. And you know, clearly that has been the case. You know, China, I guess, has been the huge example of that over the last 20, 30 years. But I don't think, you know, that model is not going to work long term for everywhere. And what you tend to get, and certainly, you know, I talk about it a little bit in the book. If you look back at English agricultural history, you quite often get people moved off the land in one way or another but without really very good other economic opportunities for them. And that's, you know, that's certainly happening in many parts of the world today with unemployed or underemployed people, you know, looking for work in cities. And like you say, that, you know, that is a recipe for conflict and problems of the sort that increasingly I think we will see.
You know, and China itself is a wonderful example of the conflict of a small farm in a big farm world. Because as you say, much of Chinese agriculture, traditional agriculture, is the agriculture of very small parcels. And how, you know, one person could support 20 people on a quarter acre of land. They had that kind of technology, but that technology is being displaced by industrial technology, wherein China wishes to modernize its agriculture. So instead of every farmer having a two or three pigs, they're switching over to the CAFO, the giant confined animal feeding operations, and converting that small farm enterprise into an industrial farm enterprise. So the people move into town. And what do they do in the town? Work in a factory, as long as there's something for that factory to make. But when there's nothing for that factory to make, then what do? You can't go back to the land anymore. So how do we get people back to the land?
Well, it's a good question. And, you know, often, you know, certainly some of the research in China points to the way that, you know, that the that there are temporary urban workers who are implicitly supported, you know, by what's going on in back in the home villages and so on. So there's a whole set of urban rural issues we need to be debating, and a whole set of issues about technology, where exactly as you said, you know, moving from a relatively biologically efficient small holding where you're using things like pigs and cycling fertility and so on, you know, we're moving to confined feeding operations, which are efficient at one level, you know, in terms of output or cost, but not necessarily efficient in terms of climate, energy use, and so on. So, you know, again, as I say in the book, I'm not kind of laying out some blueprint where I say, hey, I've got all the answers to how we can do this. I'm partly saying, you know, this is what we need to be debating. But I think, you know, going back to your intro, I think we're going to start seeing, or we're already starting to see, the fraying of the business as usual model, you know, cities and central governments struggling, really. Sometimes I liken it to a juggler, you know, more and more balls are being trying to keep in the air, and eventually the juggler starts dropping some of them. And I think we're kind of in that situation now, when the balls are beginning to get dropped. And that, I think, is the opportunity when, wherever we are, you know, whether we're in a big city or whether we're in a rural situation, we need to start thinking about, well, you know, how do I actually generate my livelihood? How do I get food on my table? How do I work with other people to ensure the flow of things that I need? Because I can't necessarily rely on these big globalized distribution systems to do it for me anymore. So I think, you know, really urgently, we need to start talking about that and start developing models. And obviously, there's not going to be one model that is the right model for everywhere in the world. It's going to have to be local and context specific. But, you know, this is the debate that we need to start having, that, you know, in my opinion, we should have been on this quicker, basically.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the most popular expressions I've heard these days, talking about this and that, is the word reimagine. We need to reimagine this, and we need to reimagine that, and we need to reimagine everything. And I think that's a good expression for what we need to do right now. We need to reimagine the small farm in today's world of big. And so you brought up the notion that small farms can't be the same thing everywhere. When I wrote Metro Farm and researched successful small farmers around the United States, I came to recognize that each one of them was as unique as their thumbprint. No two were doing the same thing in the same way. And I think you opened up your chapter on small farms by saying that they're essentially, each farm is a little ecosystem into itself.
Right. Yeah, and each locality or region, you know, you can build it up at different levels. I mean, you know, one thing that's happened in global farming is that we've become more and more reliant on a handful of big commodity crops, you know, wheat, soy, canola, and so on. And I mean, obviously those crops, you know, that they've become popular for a reason. They, you know, they have many benefits, but they've tended to undermine more local alternatives and local food cultures. And, you know, we've sort of got into this mindset, you know, that the thing you hear a lot here when people debate about the efficiency of local versus non-local food, you know, here in the UK, people say, well, tomatoes, as we say, tomatoes, I guess you say, are... you know, the ones that are grown in Spain have a lower footprint than ones that are grown with heat in tunnels, in hoop houses here in Britain. But the immediate question then is like, well, you know, why are we growing them with heat out of season, you know, when we could be eating other things that are growing seasonally here? You know, so we've kind of lost that sense of appropriate food that's seasonal and local. And of course there's other issues, you know, with water in Spain, for example. You know, so although the energy footprint for those that do use heat here maybe better with the imported ones, the water footprint goes the other way, you know. So that's part of my argument for a small farm future, is that we need to be looking at all these things simultaneously. You know, what energies are we using? What, you know, what local crops can we grow? You know, and what sort of life do we want to lead ultimately? And that, I think, pushes us into, you know, a more local and regional and more varied diet with the things that are appropriate to produce locally.
Well, you know, you brought up an interesting notion with respect to commodities. And I think that what I've learned over the years is that commodities is a business in which those who grow the most for the least win. Right. And so if you're a small farmer, you can't grow commodities and compete successfully. Now, I had a farmer from Arkansas call me up one day, a year or two back, and he said, Michael, I grow the best watermelons in Arkansas, but I'm not making any money. And I said, well, right, if you're growing the best watermelons in Arkansas and you're not making any money, then you're doing something wrong. What is it that you're doing wrong? And so I asked him how he sold his watermelons. And he said, well, a guy comes by with a big truck, and I put the watermelons up there, and he takes them into the city and sells them for me. And I said, well, sir, as soon as you put your watermelons on that truck, they became a commodity. And you've lost.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
So the question then becomes, how can farmers find special ways of growing crops, special crops, and make those crops valuable enough for people that want to buy them?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and it's not an easy one to answer. I mean, the way that we've done it on our small farm is exactly that process that you just mentioned with the watermelon farmer, where we make sure that we don't put our produce on a big truck.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we sell local and direct. But obviously, if everyone was doing that, and, you know, it takes us back to that conversation about big cities and so on, you know, that would imply a very different way of organizing the way we live. And of course, globally, that's kind of how it happens, that cheap commodity crops that are grown either, you know, with explicit financial subsidies or with implicit fossil fuel subsidies, that's what's pushing a lot of poor people out of the countryside, out of farming, and back into all that sort of urban violence and poverty that we were talking about earlier. I mean, the way I think it's going to play out, I was talking about this at another event a day or two ago. I mean, the COVID crisis has been horrific, but has also, I think, sort of made people think about how this is going to work. I mean, you know, well,
that's an interesting thing to bring up. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd love to pick that up. The COVID crisis has really opened our eyes to the fact that we are very, very vulnerable in this world of ours. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today, we're talking about small farms with Chris Smage, who is the author of A Small Farm Future, just out from Chelsea Green. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, a little tiny bug showed up all the way from China and changed the way the world sees its future. When that coronavirus first hit, everybody ran out and bought toilet paper. Because you have to have toilet paper. That's the most important thing. And then what about food? And, oh my goodness, look how vulnerable we really are. In this world, when a little tiny bug like this can totally pull the rug out from underneath us. And so we start looking around for a different way of doing things. And maybe we should look to the small farm, which is what Chris is telling us in his book, A Small Farm Future. So how did the coronavirus shake our world up, Chris?
Well, I think, I mean, in a couple of ways. I mean, certainly here locally, suddenly the supermarkets ran out of a lot of food, and particularly they ran out of fresh fruit and vegetables, which is, you know, one of the hardest things to organize big extended supply chains with. And so, you know, all of a sudden, you know, we normally get maybe one or two new customer queries a week, and all of a sudden it was more like a couple of hundred, you know. And I think that is, we were talking earlier about the various crises I talk about at the start of the book, and I think any one of those, or most of those at any rate, you know, I think there are some shocks that are coming down the pipe of the kind that we've recently experienced with COVID. And I think that does start to make people think about, partly like you were saying earlier with urban farming, people getting more interested in gardening and producing fruit and veg on small urban plots or their gardens. I mean, that's all great stuff. You know, I think we need to break down this distinction between the farmer, the professional, and, the amateur grower.
I have a great description for that. When I put together Metro Farm, I had to make that distinction for people who are thinking about farming on a small parcel of land, because there's two ways of looking at this. You can look at it as if you're having fun, in which case what you're really doing is gardening. Or you can look at it as a business, in which case you're farming. And those are two different worlds. One is fun, and the other is work.
Yeah. And also, as you were pointing out earlier with the watermelon example, I mean, if you've got a small lot and you want to make some money, then you will probably grow some high-end, you'll be thinking about sort of fancy salad crops and leaves or, high-end fruit sort of stuff. Whereas, with something like COVID, you're thinking, well, I need to feed myself, and you'll be thinking about potatoes or something like that.
And that's exactly what people were shopping for, were those staples that they could store.
Right.
To heck with the apple, with oranges or tomatoes, because they wanted something that they could put in the pantry that they could keep and make bread with down the way.
Right. So, I mean, that's where, there's this interesting intersection between, things that we like to grow for fun, things that we actually need to, put the nutrients we need in our bodies and the things that we can buy on commodity markets. But obviously, global commodity markets are fickle, you know, and that's what we've been learning with COVID. And I think we'll learn with many of the other crises coming down the pipe. So, again, you know, this is exactly the debate we need to have about how do we take care of our needs locally. And that might not be by buying the cheapest food that we possibly can on, on global markets.
Well, you brought something up earlier that really caught my attention, and that was the notion of subsidies. Implicit subsidies and explicit, I think you said, subsidies.
Right.
How did you put that?
What I meant really was, you know, an explicit subsidy is, you know, like here in the EU, Britain, we're about to leave the EU, and that's going to be a huge thing for farming, but perhaps we won't get into that. But historically, farmers in the European Union have been paid money basically to farm. I mean, it's this kind of weird system where farmers, the money they make is less than the cost of production, and then it's buttressed with these government subsidies. And, you know,
so that would be an explicit subsidy.
That would be an explicit subsidy, and I don't know too much about the U.S. system, but obviously,
but it's pretty much the same. Pretty much the same thing.
Yeah. When I say implicit subsidies, I suppose I'm thinking of things like fossil fuels, where they're very cheap and they do a lot of work on the farm, and we're not really paying the full costs in terms of the carbon emissions associated with them. And the fact that they're a non-renewable resource, so, you know, we're not going to be able to carry on doing this. And of course, you know, when you compare farming globally, in rich countries like the US and the UK, energy, you know, fuel is relatively cheap, whereas human labor is costly. It's kind of the other way around in a lot of poorer countries where, you know, it's hard to get hold of fuel or fertilizer for most farmers, whereas human labor is, you know, there's no lack of it. And that creates, that's essentially why it's pretty hard for farmers in poor countries to compete with, the sort of grain farming that's coming out of the US or parts of Europe, you know, that are subsidized both with those direct subsidies, but also with the degree of mechanization and the cheapness of fossil energy. And obviously the sort of downstream costs of, fertilizer pollution and so on and so on.
Well, you know, Chris, over the course of the years, I've come up with, just doing these show for 1,250 shows, I've come up with three laws of the food chain. And the third law of the food chain is cheap food isn't. And when I get into discussions with people about how efficient industrial agriculture is, I have this notion that if industrial agriculture had to pay the true costs of its production and did not have those explicit and implicit subsidies, that the productivity of the small farm would be much, much, much greater than that of the industrial scale farm. And I wonder,
yeah, I think
I wonder about that with respect to that farmer of 40 centuries in China who can with a quarter acre support a family of 20. Whereas, you know, when you take that farmer off the land and move him into the city and then, you know, plow up all the land as if it were one land, one parcel, and plant commodities, I don't know. It's kind of scary.
Yeah. No, well, I think that's exactly right. You know, cheap food isn't cheap when you compute everything. And you know, one of the questions here is, you know, what are we actually looking for out of the food system? You know, the way it's gone in the wealthy countries is, to produce food at the cheapest financial price. Whereas, you know, just as we were saying a few minutes ago, if you're on a small farm and you're providing food for yourself, you're faced with a very different set of questions. And that's like, you know, how can I get the food I need out of this plot with the minimum amount of, you know, of my work or the maximum amount of pleasure in my farming. And that pushes you in a very different direction. But certainly there's quite a lot of research studies that show, certainly in poor countries, small farms can actually be more productive. You know, if we're talking about yield per acre, small farms even now can be more productive than larger farms. And as you say, once you start computing the, you know, the costs of the, you know, pollution and the carbon and energy costs involved in, in bigger industrialized farming, you know, that finding only gets the stronger.
Yeah, and when it gets right down to it, I guess the best or worst of all possible examples of cheap food and cheap labor was the example of slavery and how some farmers thought they were getting a very good deal. But in the long run, it was very expensive labor to that cheap labor was. And so there's so many ways that we go about hiding those true costs that don't show up for a few years down the road, but when they do show up, they really do show up. Another example, of course, is nitrogen fertilizer and the nitrification of aquifers, which we're experiencing here in California's Central Coast. All of a sudden, our aquifers are polluted with nitrates. And so, you know, the nitrogen was cheap energy for the plants, but not so cheap in the long run. And so do you see any, maybe that's what you're talking about. Maybe these things that have been hidden are just going to become popped to the surface and we're going to have to pay that cost. And if we have to pay cost...
Yeah.
That's when we start to rethink the whole notion of a future of a small farm then, huh?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, you know, that there are very sort of complex feedback loops between all these things. So, you know, your fertilizer example was a good one where in the rich countries, you know, fertilizer is relatively cheap and farmers, you know, really they have to, you know, they're incentivized to slap on as much fertilizer as they can possibly get away with in order to get, you know, small incremental gains in yield. Whereas in a lot of poor countries, you know, fertilizer is unaffordable to farmers, or if they do buy it, you know, they get on this kind of fertilizer treadmill. But actually, you know, if we were being rational about how we allocated it globally, that fertilizer could be much more productive on the smaller farms of poorer farmers in developing countries than in places like the US or the UK. I mean, there's a whole interesting debate to be had about whether we can do away with synthetic fertilizer altogether globally, and perhaps we won't get into that now. But certainly, I think, you know, when
I would weigh in on that. And I would say we can get rid of mechanical or chemical fertilizers, but to do that, we have to put people back on the land, and not just people, but smart people.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, you were talking earlier about the, you know, the Chinese farmers of 40 centuries. I mean, that's exactly the issue. And, you know, one issue obviously is the hard work of that kind of labor. But hopefully, as I was saying earlier, you know, it's not about going back to some, you know, to some past where we're not able to use some of the technologies and some of the ideas that have emerged more recently, but to think about that balance of labor. And certainly a lot of the studies I see that say, no, we can't, you know, we can't feed the world organically, they tend that, you know, they're not making the assumption that, or they're making the assumption that that's at existing levels of labor input into farming. And, you know, I guess the whole thrust of this conversation we've been having is, you know, we need more people in farming. You know, for sure, we can debate how many and, you know, the levels of all of these things. But ultimately, you know, we need more people back on the land. We need a small farm future.
And to do so, we have to make it possible for them to make a living. They have to right. make a good living, have to make an honorable living. And I guess that's really why I focus so much on the business of small farming in my book, Metro Farm, because those people who I found that weren't making any money didn't hang around very long. They left.
Right.
But those people who did figure out how to generate a good living and an honorable living and stayed. And they stayed and stayed yeah. and stayed. So that's going to be the secret of pulling this off, I think. But do you really think that a world based on this alternative form of agriculture, this opposite of the industrial model, can actually feed the world, or would we all starve to death?
No, I mean, I think unquestionably it can feed the world. And I think, you know, we were talking about local food cultures and so on earlier. I mean, I think it can feed the world better than the existing model. And, you know, let's not forget there's still, again, there's a debate over the figures, but there's getting up to a billion people globally, at least, who are physically undernourished and not getting the food they need. And meanwhile, of course, in the richer countries, there's a lot of people who have got diseases of affluence from eating too much of the wrong kind of food, you know. So we really need to rethink the food system. And I think if we can reconfigure it to be a smaller scale, more localized farming system, where I think, you know, part of it is that everybody has to get more interested in the food system and the farming
system.
There you
go. And the best way to do that for city people is to find food with your farmer's face on it. And when you find that food, you've got yourself a farmer and you've reconnected. Folks, this has been The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host, with Chris Mage, the author of A Small Farm Future, all the way from England. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain radio show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.